and introduce the last panel, which is a looking forward discussion. Again, it's 35 minutes, so we're going to try and stick to the presentation time of 35 minutes in order to allow for public comment before 5 p.m. So we'll try and get through this as quick as we can. We have three presenters on this panel and allow them to introduce themselves. Thank you.
All right, as we're getting started, we'll go ahead and introduce ourselves. Again, I'm Abby Taylor Silva with the Grower Shipper Association of Central California.
I'm Chris Beal. I'm with the Vineyard Team.
And Kirk Schmidt with the Sustainable Ag Water Corporation. I will be going first. Many of the things that you asked us about before this hearing dealt with what agriculture proposes to do to improve water quality that are inconsistent with the goals and objectives of not only this region, but the State Board as enunciated in the East San Joaquin Order. We recognize these challenges, and it is our common goal to improve water quality with yours. We've talked about irrigation, nutrient management, pesticides, food safety, ranch management, reporting and data management that was just finished. But now we're going to talk about how we're going to improve water quality, and we're going to initially look at this in a series similar to the series of bullet points that the state has enumerated in the East San Joaquin Order. One of the first considerations that we talked about today were irrigation practices. This is very important to agriculture, and the very complex farming practices that we have make it difficult to come up with a simplistic way of describing how to best irrigate a crop. However, the overarching goal is to minimize irrigation so that you keep the fertilizer within the root zone to the extent that is possible. This is also a key goal of SGMA, the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, and which in many cases in the Central Coast is going to compel growers to use less water, so you have a compatible goal with conservation. We don't have any proposals today to deal with just irrigation issues. However, we're going to bring a series of concepts to you that will be included in the information that will be given to you before your next hearing in November when you're considering options that may be included in the new order. We talked about nitrogen management, and agriculture has submitted a proposal on how to report and deal with nitrogen management and the irrigation issues for a large ranch as a reporting unit instead of reporting it on a either crop-by-crop basis or a block-by-block basis, because it's impossible to sort out the actual potential loading of the ranch if you do it on this piecemeal basis. While it's much simpler and more effective and scientifically accurate if we look at it on a ranch basis over the course of the year. And so we have proposed and given written backup of the proposal to you of a measure to report on nitrate removed on every ranch annually. And this is consistent with the precedential requirement in the East San Joaquin Order. The total crop harvested by crop would be used to calculate the N removed. Growers would track the yield by crop and by harvest until there is a coefficient for determining the N removed and keep records of this so that this could be back calculated when those coefficients are available. The regional, your board, would conduct public hearings on the establishment of the N removed coefficients as is mandated by the East San Joaquin Order, and this would mean that the end result of this would be tracking fertilizer the same way it's tracked on a 200-acre almond ranch in the Central Valley, where the total amount of N applied and the total amount of N removed would be the ratios you're looked at, and it would give you better data than looking at all the minute details. One of the things that we've gone through repeatedly today is the use of outliers as a metric for follow-up and to encourage compliance. We believe that by not only identifying outliers and by having your board notify outliers, that they are outliers, whether it's in nutrient use or on other metrics, that this is the most likely way to encourage improved performance, and in the case of a fertilizer, to lead into a more rapid reduction in loading to groundwater. Water is percolating into the aquifer in a rate that may take decades to reach the aquifer. So water quality presently in many aquifers shows historic use, not current use. As growers use less N, the concentration of N percolating into groundwater will reduce and dilute the existing nitrate concentrations, so it will improve the groundwater concentration, and over time will reach the goals that you have as an objective. But it cannot be demanded immediately just because of the nature of water percolating into aquifers. While some aquifers may take years, some aquifers that we have in the Central Coast take decades for the water to actually reach. In order to help you track, one of the things that both your staff and your board in previous orders have required, and the state board in East San Joaquin highlights as one of their requirements, is an irrigation and nutrient management plan. And you've gone to the extent of requiring reporting of effectiveness on the irrigation and nutrient management plan. Agriculture will be presenting to you some proposals and concepts about how irrigation and nutrient management plans may be more effective at encouraging compliance and also give you the data necessary to track how people are performing without, again, excessive requirements that are not going to show you a declining in the possibility of loading to groundwater or in manners that wouldn't allow you to track reduced irrigation. But this is something that we're going to be preparing and giving to your staff so that you'll have it for your next hearing as one of the options. One of the things that we really need to look at for all of these is what type of reporting is required. And agricultural associations have been meeting with staff on a regular basis since the East San Joaquin order was released in February to work out some of the kinks in this process so that the reporting requirements can be both effective for you and reasonable for agriculture. And we've identified areas that we believe can definitely aid in your data collection set without overwhelming your IT people. However, we need to ask your help. In order to reach these objectives, particularly with the issues of N removed coefficient, there needs to be a process to adopt N removal coefficients for a majority of crops on the Central Coast that don't presently have them. You cannot come up with hypothetical N nitrate removed coefficients. The East San Joaquin order specifically requires that there be a public hearing on N removed coefficients and that there be a decision by your board adopting specific N removal coefficients per crop and that this be done in consultation with the state board. It's really important for us that this occurs because we have so many diverse crops. In the Central Valley, they have a million acres of almonds. We have many, many growers that might grow 30 or 40 crops, none of which have N removed coefficients. And there's so many small varieties, or we also have potted plant nurseries, and we have an extensive number of nurseries that just go transplants that don't exist in the Central Valley to that extent. And there's no way to value the N removed in a transplant operation when it's sold to some other grower. We have talked repeatedly about using outliers as a method of encouraging compliance, and this is absolutely consistent with the East San Joaquin order where they use outliers as a method of encouraging compliance. But again, having an outlier is only helpful if the outlier is notified that they're an outlier. Having, you know, someone have an academic knowledge of who's an outlier without informing them does not cause change because they will not change their practices to cease becoming an outlier. And so informing them as part of your administrative process is absolutely necessary. We are also very cognizant of your concerns about surface water quality and toxicity. And we do have some areas that have had persistent toxicity, and we have some areas where the toxicity has gone down, and over the last several years, there has been no toxicity. So if we look again at the outlier approach, as a method of putting a hierarchy or ranking of how to best deal with toxicity, it would be best to come up with a system where areas that have repeated toxicity, the growers would be notified. In the 14 years of the Ag Order, and as you know, I ran Preservation, Inc., we've done a wonderful job of determining the quality of water in the Central Coast. Good, bad, or indifferent, whatever it is, we have it down. We do not know of any instance where an entire sub-watershed has been notified by this board that they are not meeting water quality standards. If we don't tell the growers that they're not meeting water quality standards, there's no reason to believe that they will make changes to improve and reach those. And lastly, in order to help them reach those standards, we need a very viable, solid educational requirement, which is also something that is mandated by the East San Joaquin Order, because if we identify a problem, the grower has to learn how to solve the problem. And these are things that we will include in our proposals to you before your next board meeting. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Chris Beal. I'm with the Central Coast Vineyard Team, or Vineyard Team. And so I'm here representing vineyards, which is a little bit different. Just as a little background, we've been working with staff and the regional board over the years. I've been with the group for 20 years. Our mission is to promote sustainable wine growing. We do that through a variety of programs of tailgates and workshops and seminars and conferences, and now we podcast, which is kind of cool. But all of our really work is around kind of affecting grower behavior on the vineyard. When we're talking about water quality, really, I think what's been emphasized here is that what matters are practices and behavior, and we want to be influencing that. We want to be using good information to inform kind of the outreach that's going on with their growers so that they can make the best decision to eventually improve water quality. I wanted to echo a little bit about the comments in terms of research and education. Again, that's a lot of what we do. There were times when we got, you know, really wonderful grants from the regional board in terms of cover cropping and roads management and IPM. And it's been a long time since there have been water quality grants. I don't know what the process is, but certainly if there are opportunities to partner in terms of funding and really trying to explore some of the critical issues that we've identified today, then that would be great. In terms of the third party that's been brought up before, we have the Sustainability in Practice, or SIP, certification program. I think this program is interesting in that it's looking at the whole farm. As we've been talking about earlier, it really does take a holistic effort to be addressing water quality issues as a whole, looking at soils, stormwater, irrigation, nutrient, pest management. And the certification program certainly addresses all of those things. I think it's interesting in terms of a certification, because we can be responsive and dynamic in terms of the standards and the rules. The other thing that's it's been recognized in the prior order, which has been a good thing for a lot of growers. It's incentivized certification, which is really reflecting the kind of practices that are being adopted on the ground, which protect water quality. So in terms of this particular model, I think there are opportunities for other types of groups and coalitions and different types of certifications that make sense. It's been a nice thing for our growers, and I think using the regulatory structure to incentivize the adoption of practices is certainly a good option, because in the end, if growers adopt practices, then that will achieve results if we're sort of heading in the right direction of the type of practices that we're using. But, you know, just to wrap up, because I know we're kind of running, you know, short on time, I just want to emphasize kind of this partnership idea. So we've been working with staff and working with the board for a long time. I've been with this group for 20 years. We have a lot of experience in our organization in terms of how to reach growers, how to influence behavior, how to collect and analyze data. We've had successful attempts at that, and we've had not so successful attempts with that. We're here to be a partner with staff to help craft a program that makes sense in terms of the information needs from the staff to prioritize you know, regulatory issues and some compliance issues. We can help inform the creation of this model, what makes sense for growers. In the end, we want the information to help inform growers' decisions. So I think there have been a couple of comments earlier about, you know, the type of information that we're asking. And I think there's a couple of different issues. One is the type of information that we want growers to be paying attention to when they're making decisions about their farming practices. A lot of times we've been talking about that. That's different than what is the information that we want growers to report in terms of this regulatory framework. So, and I think it's important to kind of just remember what it is that you're going for, what the purpose is of the information. And certainly we're here to be, you know, a partner in terms of developing a program to gather information in terms of the practices, the transport. There are new things that are revealing themselves today that we didn't have information on 10 years ago. We need that information, and we would like to be a partner in that moving forward. So thanks for your time.
Okay, so my job is to wrap it all up. Lucky me. So, first off, I want to say, as you can see on the screen, there are 10 different associations that came together for this presentation today, and we are working very hard. We're meeting pretty regularly. As you already know, Farm Bureau, Monterey County, and Grower Shipper already are meeting very regularly alongside the Sustainable Ag Water Corp to talk about ideas, and then we're bringing that back to the trade association. They're bringing ours. We're working really, really diligently to bring you some solutions. So I want to try to address your questions in my 19 and a half minutes. So there, of your questions, there were a few key overarching things that, from our perspective, the regional board could very much help us with, and those are, and I'm going to apologize. I wish I had these up on the screen for you. Like I said, getting 10 organizations to have these discussions, sometimes it takes a while, and we just couldn't make it by the deadline to get the PowerPoint. So things regional board could do to help us: clear schedules, templates, and processes. You heard Joe Pizzini talk about the audits, and you heard how, what you might not have heard is we know what the metrics look like and what the audits standards are months in advance. So when our members go into their season, they know what they're going to be audited against. There's not always that level of clarity in our water quality regulations. That would be appreciated. Clear schedules, templates, and processes. Thank you. Thanks. Move this up a little bit. The methodology for data analysis should be very clear. And a good example, and we are talking with staff, and we did a Public Records Act request on the TNA analysis. There are some things in there that to us aren't clear. Jocelyn talked about the 2-acre feet, right? I think that the methodology for how data is analyzed, that being transparent and clear before there are any reports out, would be fantastic. The specification of the outlier process methodology, so you've heard a lot about outliers today. For a grower to be able to understand, why am I an outlier, and how do I come back and share with you, well, you know what, I actually shouldn't be an outlier for these reasons. What's the process for that? Eliminating the overlap. So spending some time over the next couple of months really working on what's in the East San Joaquin, what's in Ag Waiver 3.0, what doesn't need to be done, maybe that's being done now because it's addressed in the East San Joaquin, the farm plans, there are a number of things and templates that we're already filling out that maybe they could be used to meet the East San Joaquin requirement, or maybe they're no longer necessary. Work with agriculture to identify the assumptions inherent to the proposed options and the questions that we have today. I think a good example of that is I really appreciated the dialogue, especially between Director Young and the food safety panel around, you know, are we micromanaging? And I think that that's I think that you've heard a lot about functional equivalence and different things that we think we can do. But it's also important to remember that the beneficial uses and the way that they were designated didn't always make a lot of sense. So I think that has to also be part of the discussion. I've given the example before of the Blanco Drain. You know, it's fishable, navigable, swimmable. Have you ever driven by the Blanco Drain? Do you want to go swimming in it? I don't think so, right? But that was in the 70s when those requirements had to be sent to the EPA. There were a lot of things that were just kind of blanketed. And so I think that has to be part of that discussion, but I do appreciate the thought about we need to be able to kind of let the growers determine what makes sense on their field. So specific to your questions, your first question was, what can growers and the regional board do to demonstrate quantifiable progress to minimize nitrate discharge to groundwater and to achieve water quality objectives? The things the regional board could definitely help with are allocating grant funding to coefficient research and conducting education. I think the more that we have regional board staff come and talk to our growers about the bigger picture, about why the regulation, it's very helpful. The things that growers are currently doing and some could still continue to do is measure and report nitrogen applied, especially around new N, which you heard a lot about today. And then also measure and report nitrogen removed on a ranch basis annually. That cuts to the proposal that Kirk referred to, and it's what's mandated in the East San Joaquin. Additionally, I think as we're looking at that data, we need to work on comparing similar things when determining outliers. You heard a lot about that today. And we need to irrigate with the goal of keeping water within the root zone. In terms of your second question, what can growers and the regional board do to demonstrate quantifiable progress to minimize nutrient discharge to surface waters to achieve water quality objectives? I think that the AR metrics and everything I just said regarding question one, a lot of that really applies, right? It still applies to this question. And I think that the few things we could do is we could really incentivize BMP adoption and new innovation adoption. We could really focus on amending some of our legal constraints. And when I say that, I mean there are legal constraints that a lot of us have talked about that really prevent collective treatment and mitigation of surface water and tile drains. And I think we need to address how to get through those legal constraints. Supporting research, especially around tile drain management practices, to allow active management. Consider load and concentration. It cuts straight to what Sarah told you in the last panel, right? Look at those together. Collaborate with us as you're determining your outlier determination methods. I think we could bring a lot of ideas to that, and I think we actually will be. And make that determination a really transparent process, again. And in terms of what growers can and could do, you know, many growers, as you heard today, don't have any irrigation runoff anymore. That's changed significantly in the last 14 years. So these farms aren't contributing to the surface water nutrient impairment, but you're going to see from us some proposals regarding activities for ranches that do have surface water or tailwater impairment and how we can work through those issues. Question number three was, what can growers and the regional board do to demonstrate quantifiable progress to minimize toxicity in surface waters from pesticide discharges to achieve WQO? I think a few things that could be done are improving CDEN and CCAMP websites and the feedback loop for those. I've heard a number of times, I know that might be bigger than this regional board, but we've just heard that the data that reflected there is not very current. I think also supporting efforts to mitigate sediment loading, so identifying management practices that can help us to mitigate. Funding sediment movement research and education. Goes back to your grant funds. Is there a way to bring that into this type of research? Identifying sub-watersheds using credible sources. And I think you heard that from Sarah as well, and maybe it was Kirk, but helping to identify what are the sub-watersheds of concern and then educating the growers in those areas that we are concerned because of this information, and using credible sources such as Preservation Inc. And then we just generally a recognition that further analysis is needed. You've heard a couple of times today, if you can't define a problem, you can't solve a problem. And I think that, you know, you've heard a little bit from us about further analysis needed on temporal and spatial characteristics of the data that we're looking at from other databases. Again, Sarah's touched on that, especially in regard to neonicotinoids. And This is another question in the grower perspective. We're working on some solutions to bring to you. Again, we're trying to bring together a lot of different groups in agriculture, but we are working on some ideas for you for your next meeting. In terms of the fourth question, and that was, what can growers and the regional board do to ensure that riparian and wetland habitat is protected due to ag activities and discharges? A key question that we actually have back to you on that question is, are you referring to new or existing riparian and wetland habitat? Because we weren't clear. But I think a few points are that we should not be requiring artificial wetlands or vegetative buffers. There's been a lot of discussion about that today and the why. We should also be balancing the priorities, right? So you heard a lot about food safety, and that whole discussion is meant to help, I think, you understand the many challenges that a grower has to face as they're trying to bring their product to market and really maintain a healthy product. So providing that opportunity for the growers to make some choices around how they manage is going to be important. Focusing on functional equivalents. Again, illegal constraints to collect treatment need to be addressed. And treatment areas should not be deemed wetlands. If they're built for this purpose, they shouldn't be called a wetland. They shouldn't be treated the same. Regarding question number 5, what can growers and the regional board do to demonstrate quantifiable progress to minimize sediment discharge? I think a lot of that was actually addressed in the previous question as well. Balancing priorities, artificial wetlands or vegetative buffers should not be required. But what are growers doing? So growers, we need to work with our growers to make sure they're managing to minimize impairment. Absolutely. And impairment to existing downstream riparian or wetland habitat. Working with our growers to manage discharge. And we're actively working on a plan for this right now. We want to bring you a plan so that to identify the areas impaired by sediment and how to manage around those, and looking at a number of different factors, because there are, as you are well aware, a number of factors that influence that. And to your final question, how can the regional board use discharge permit requirements to ensure current and future affordable, safe, and clean water for drinking and environmental uses? And as you're well aware, right, your authority to require replacement water is limited. However, and I mean, we could speak to the law and all that, but it's important to remember and recognize what you've heard before, that in the irrigated lands program throughout the region, most growers have been and are providing water if that's needed by the people who are living on their farms. In the Salinas Valley, you also have an ag-led stewardship group that's addressing this concern specifically. We also supported, and I'm going to just speak for Grower Shipper right now. This does not necessarily reflect the others listed here. We also did support a statewide drinking water bill. As you're, I'm sure, aware, for reasons and influences really outside of our control and the control of the environmental justice community, who we really worked very diligently with on that, that did not move forward this year. We're still looking at a long-term solution. We really think that that's vital and important. And also, improvement has already begun in many ways over the last 14 years. I'm going to stop there. I know how challenging it can be just to be spoken at for such a long time, but I really welcome your questions. I hope that we started to address your questions, and we really are working diligently to bring you more in your next meeting.
Thank you, Abby. And I will now change and move to my right and see if we'll have any question.
Okay, you don't have any? Go ahead. Okay, so Abby, incentivizing BMP adoption and just incentives in general, we haven't had a lot of discussion about incentives, and so I'm curious, kind of in a broad sense of when you come back to us, if there are some thoughts on what incentives mean for you, how you define those, and how incentives can be used.
I think very broadly, and again, needing to vet ideas with our partners as a whole, but very broadly, if there is a watershed that has specific issues, the regional board has said this is a watershed with great impairment for all of these reasons, then it goes back to this idea of a grower should be able to make some choices about what's going to make most sense on their field. I think that if a grower is bringing in
innovation, new innovation, BMPs, trialing BMPs, that grower's risk in being in that area should be lowered, right? That grower should be able to show, these are the things I'm doing with everything we know, all the science we have, all the new ideas coming forward. And to me, that incentivizes that innovation. I think that, you know, you heard Joe Pizzini talk a little bit about the nitrate harvester. It's so true that Dale Huss and his bringing our water committee out to look at that, talking about it whenever anyone asked, has led to more growers looking at nitrate harvester options that look different, but I think have been, they're open to the idea more because they've heard about others doing it. I can't say enough how important it is to provide incentives for people to try new things.
Thank you.
I just want to thank the panel, and I want to thank Abby and Norm Groot for their work to organize this panel and bring these particular speakers today, some of whom we know really well and others who we're meeting for the first time. You raised some very intriguing suggestions with potential, which is what we're hoping this panel would allow us to start to hear about, understand the things that you're focusing on, and where you see connections between East San Joaquin and the next order. It's going to be a very important and critical piece of the conversation as we go through the next months. So I'm very, very encouraged, and I want to thank everybody today for their contribution to the conversation.
Jim? Mike? No?
I just want to thank everybody also. I think it's been really informative. It's given me lots of food for thought. It has confirmed some thoughts I've had over the years about how perhaps I think we should be going about this. And I just wanted to ask staff something that I've heard for the first time, and it just didn't dawn on me that maybe we weren't doing this. And that is, and maybe we are, do we gather up the data that we have analyzed either by the growers or staff, and do we send this out to the farmers and say, you know, this is what's kind of going on with water quality, and you know, the data is going, here's how we're using the data, here's what the data is showing us. By the way, here are the 303D listed bodies in your area. That never occurred to me whether we were doing that or not, and I think that it's probably a good idea to be doing that.
This is Chris Rose. I'm with the Water Board. Quite frankly, we could do a better job at that. We've certainly made attempts. A lot of our attempts have been at Water Board meetings. We hold workshops and so on. We go to workshops and we also hold workshops. Quite frankly, when we host a workshop, our experiences at the faces we see are the same people you know by first name. It's when we're invited to a workshop led by the UC Cooperative Extension where they have a number of growers in the room who have to get credit for something they're doing some sort of educational outreach. That is when we reach growers. And so it's something that, frankly, I think that we can work with the growers and with the advocates more closely on, and how we can reach the growers, because, quite frankly, we could do a better job, and we don't quite know how to do it. We've also heard we tried letters, and but again, from what we hear from growers and also from the advocates, is that essentially any letter from us is frowned upon. That even if we try to word it very carefully, we just can't quite seem to word it correctly. So this is something that we're working on, and we are working on in the moment, and we have staff working on it even today as we are sitting here working on this. And I'm not going to go into any more detail, but it's something that we're aware of and that we're working on.
Okay. Well, there are some things we do better than others.
Yes.
And I think, you know, it's just the reality of us being a regulatory agency and not really having a good, you know, history and background and experience in how to do kind of public outreach. I mean, I that's just the reality of kind of who we are. I think it would behoove us to figure out how best to get the relevant information data that pertains to growers in an area, in a sub-watershed, somehow, in a very simplistic way, to let those individuals know, you know, here's how things look in your neighborhood.
Yeah, we completely agree. And not only for the implementation of... Sorry.
Go ahead. I give you permission.
Yeah, thank you. I'll be quick. Not only for the current ag order and implementing it, because frankly we're not sitting still and we want to outreach and let growers know what we are finding, but also we're making plans for ag order 4.0 and how we can do better disseminating that information to the growers in 4.0, and we're working on those.
And I just want to say I'm fully aware that the data is there. We've presented it publicly numerous times. It's presented in workshops. I know that.
Right.
Okay. But
sure.
I think there's a missing gap here, or there's a missing – we're missing a way to really get it to growers, I think, in a more meaningful way, because the people that come to the workshops tend to be the same people over and over again, would think.
Right.
And we're probably
right.
missing the bulk of them.
Right. Yeah, and there's this thing with trust, and, you know.
Right.
So we're working on that. So.
From the government, I'm here to help you.
Yeah, exactly.
Mayor Delgado?
I had the same question that Jane asked and about incentives. And, Abby, thank you. You answered it on purpose from a general perspective. So in the future, I'm intrigued by the potential for incentives, and I hope that staff and stakeholders can come up with some specifics to address many of these things we've talked about, these issues we've talked about today, using incentives, because I think there's a lot of potential there. And lastly, I just want to say thank you to all the speakers today. I think you all did a fantastic job. And likewise, I respect those who did the organizing, because that's one step more involvement and time, but because it came out really well as far as the organization and the breadth of presentations was just what we want, just what we wanted. In particular, Abby, thank you for answering those questions specifically and on point at the very end. That's helpful. Thank you.
Mr. Johnson?
I don't want my lack of questions to be mistaken for disinterest. I feel like I've absorbed an awful lot today, and I don't have questions that would add to it, but I really want to thank all the panelists for their frankness and honesty, and at times saying, well, I don't know what the answer is. You know, there's questions none of us have answers to. We're working on them. Thank you.
Thank you. So a couple of items, three. One, back to my earlier comment about my interest to hear more down the road about the coalitions and third parties. I think they're very important. The other one, when we talked about incentives, I reflected recently on other agencies within Cal EPA, and we do have other agencies who are very comfortable in providing incentive programs. I'll give you an easy example of California Air Resource Board, all types of incentive programs. And it doesn't have to be an incentive program. If you do XYZ, we give you $10,000. It can be, provide the farmer the ability to streamline a little bit better, or the frequency of information that I have to provide. So I'm not going to go into the details, but another example is that, we do have a lot of farmers
in the Central Coast who perform on their own without any grant or tax-funded projects, applied research. Those folks needs to be recognized. And, I know personally several, we're trying this new approach and this new cycle for irrigation or new type of irrigation types. So to me, that's how you make progress. And sometimes it's the baby steps of the boots on the ground. So that's another example, I think, of incentives that needs to be daylighted. Last quick comment is expand a little bit on my colleague, Mr. Young, in regard to micromanaging. And I think one of the danger sometime in increasing the tightness and levels of regulations and details of we want to report on this in minute details, inadvertently can drift us toward becoming prescriptive, because the more detailed requirements we have, the more you tend to migrate a little bit toward that, I'll call it the gray area. So I think down the road, again, as we continue these conversations, I think that's one area that needs to be mindful. It's similar to some of Mr. Young's comment, but it's another aspect of the unintended consequence, I think, of getting too much down to the weeds. So, Norm, you did a great job, and I thank you. And also, panelists, thank you so much. So we now can move to the public comments. And I do have a speaker card request, which was made quite some time ago by Kay. There you are, for 10 minutes. So I will start with you. And that'll be 10 minutes, Tammy.
And that's a hard act to follow, but I do have a couple of comments to make. It occurred to me last night when I was about midnight when I was writing my comments that I should just go to bed because I was going to have to rewrite them today when I heard questions from you guys, and that's exactly what happened. In terms of the six questions that were asked, a lot of my feedback on those questions were part of Abby's comments, so I'm not really going to focus on those. I'm going to talk about the standards approach that was kind of broached in the morning session, cost, what I call rural realities, and balance. So it was really good to hear comments from the board about not micromanaging growers. I think ag could get behind that. Of course, the devil's in the details. However, for the following reasons, the standards approach does give us pause. So one of the first concerns would be that the beneficial use designations may or may not be appropriate on the Central Coast. I heard some mention about in the 1970s when the beneficial uses were made. I was actually in Watsonville during a testimony made by Lisa McCann about the Watsonville, well, actually it was in SLO, about the Watsonville Slough shellfish harvesting beneficial use, and she gave extensive testimony on what it was like in the 70s when they were making those beneficial uses. A lot of it was they were under duress to meet an EPA deadline. So if you do take a standards approach, there is an issue with are the beneficial uses appropriate. Likewise, beneficial use designations, many of them are default designations. That means they really don't take the diverse characteristics of the watersheds into consideration. So that might be a concern if you were to take that approach. Likewise, ag has concerns about how permit standards have actually been developed.
a good example is the turbidity standard that's in Ag Waiver 2.0 and 3.0. It is not an EPA standard. It is adopted from a research guideline for steelhead protection. So we have many watersheds that are not in steelhead critical habitat on the Central Coast, and some watersheds that don't even have cold aquatic life beneficial uses. So we have this standard that probably wouldn't be appropriate there. So there would be a lot of work needed to have appropriate standards if you were to take a standard approach. There's concern that the standards might be based upon assumptions. I missed Sarah's testimony. It sounds like she talked a little bit about some of the NEONIC analysis that we've done. So in 2017, the Water Board did analyze NEONIC use, and they came to some conclusions. One is that NEONIC uses have increased over time. That's a fact. It's across the state, the whole country, that's true. However, the next three points, NEONIC uses have gone up because growers substituted NEONICs for other pesticides, is not true. That is likely, based upon a conversation with users, it's likely because, number one, there were more NEONIC products registered. There are hundreds of labels, product labels. And number two, many of the older NEONICs, like imidacloprid, are now generic. And one of the things that happens when they're generic, they're picked up by a lot of sub-registrants, and the price goes down and use increases. That's just a way that the pesticide industry works. The third thing, growers are using, on the Central Coast, are using some of the highest use rates per acre in the state. This isn't true. We did analysis of the NEONIC uses, as well as some other water-soluble pesticides. We did not limit this to imidacloprid. I just focused on imidacloprid. What we found is that the use rates per acre in vegetables and strawberries are much lower than many of the other crops. So there are more acres treated on the Central Coast, treated acres, not real estate acres, treated acres. So real estate acres, here's an acre, we treated it. A treated acre would be, here's an acre, it got treated three times, so you have three treated acres. Does that make sense? So there are more treated acres on the Central Coast, but largely because the use rates are lower, so they they make more applications repeatedly, whereas in the Central Valley, they use more total product, like in Tulare County and Kern County, because the use rates are so much higher. Does that make sense? Okay. The fourth thing that we found, that assumption, was that the Central Coast has unique sampling results and some of the highest concentrations in California and maybe in the U.S. When we looked at the distribution of detection exceedances and concentrations, what we found was that some of that's a sampling artifact. For example, Tulare has higher, and Kern have higher use rates than Monterey, total use, so total product use. They've never been sampled, ever, period, for imidacloprid. So you're making conclusions based upon huge data gaps. So when you look at standards, then that you know, we learn things. For example, in 2010 or 2012, when the CEQA analysis for Ag Waiver 2.0, there was actually a statement in there that said, "Well, you know, this is going to be pretty hard on broccoli, but growers can grow something else." So broccoli was like the problem child because it needs so much N. Well, now we love broccoli because we've learned since then that it has these deep roots and it scavenges nitrates. So basically, my point is we have a lot to learn, and if you start slapping standards on us at this point in time, it could be a disaster because there are so many knowledge gaps. So the standards could be very expensive, and I'd like to talk a little bit about regulatory costs. Last year, I made a presentation to the National Soil and Water Conservation Society. It was supposed to be a policy presentation, and the title was Salinas Valley 2020, the perfect regulatory storm. And what I really wanted to talk about is this train, or multiple trains, on the track coming towards agriculture. SIGMA, Irrigated Lands Regulatory Program, the Habitat Conservation Plan in the Salinas River, long-term decisions that need to be made about replacement water. Those were the four things I was focusing on. Since then, there's been discussion about the long-term Salinas River Management Plan, the Salinas River Stream Channel Maintenance Program permit renewal should happen in 2020. The growers will see additional transportation costs because of the greenhouse gas AB 32, and there'll be additional labor cost. So what was interesting is that the society didn't put me in a policy track. They put me in an economics track. So I was scrambling at the last minute to find some calculations, and I did some very rudimentary mathematics. Basically, I took the six out of the top 10 crops in Monterey County, and I tried to calculate gross net revenue. Tried to calculate net revenue for the industry. We talk about gross revenue all the time. Monterey County has $4.6 billion in gross revenue. What does that really mean if you subtract out all the production costs? So what I did is I used the Cal Poly cost and return studies, multiplied those out over the gross number of acres, and then subtracted that from the gross revenue to come up with net revenue for Monterey County. And what I found was kind of alarming. So the six crops were head lettuce, romaine hearts, broccoli, strawberries, celery, Pinot Noir, and Chardonnay. All of those, with the exception of celery, loses money unless they have high markets and high yields. So this is, kind of alarming, and because I'm not an economist, I went to Cal Poly and said, I kind of went through this process, and this is what I found. And they said, an economist wouldn't have done the calculation this way, but this merits more attention. So they decided to take a 2006 study they did where they were comparing regulatory cost to three commodity groups, lettuce, dairy, and citrus, to other parts of the country to determine the cost differential and regulatory costs. And they took the lettuce grower in the Salinas Valley, and they looked at his production costs in 2007 and regulatory costs in 2017 versus 2006. So I got the preliminary data recently. We're trying to verify everything. And the Cal Poly professors have stated that they're very, very alarmed by the numbers. We're trying to verify just to make sure they're correct before we roll them out, but I hope to bring them to you because it kind of goes to the issue of balance. How do we balance, beneficial uses with our industry? How do we balance that all out? Because it is possible we're reaching a tipping point unless we figure out better ways to coordinate our regulatory trajectories. So I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it. So next, and the remaining speakers will be 3 minutes each. We will have Ms. Bridget Hoover, and then we will have after that Dr. Lowell Zelensky. So please come to the podium.
Hello, my name is Bridget Hoover. I'm with the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary. And first, just want to thank the board for taking the time out to listen to everyone. I think it's really important to hear all of the different perspectives, both from industry and folks you'll hear from tomorrow. So thank you for that. And I just want to echo a lot of what was said today and encourage some more thought around kind of the educational component of what could be proposed in Ag Order 4.0. And I think that goes a long way to maybe address some of the challenges that have been risen, and again, recognizing it's very complex. There's a lot of issues. There's the carrot and the stick, and I always like to go with the carrot first. And I think having that educational component and even focusing that more specifically on sub-watersheds, like has been mentioned, where you can talk with growers, share information. It was mentioned earlier, you know, they're looking for progress reports. How are they doing? You know, how effective are the practices they're implementing? And I think that's a great approach. When you're looking at a sub-watershed, you're not worried about the different climatic conditions or the different soil types or those kinds of things, because they're very similar. The challenges are similar in those smaller areas. So I think that's a great way to go. And also the whole idea of recognizing the good work that is being done, incentivizing that, and whether it's looking at, you know, on-farm practices and improvements to water quality that way, or looking on the sub-watershed scale and off-farm more regional treatment systems that can be implemented. So I think there's a lot of good things happening. The idea of the TAC is also really a good idea, where you have the growers and their knowledge. They're the ones who are going to make improvement to water quality. They have, you know, the capacity to do that, the control to do that, and bringing them together with the researchers and other, you know, industry organizations. I think it's important to understand and know that, you know, the right research is being done, identifying these different innovative practices, making sure that the information that's being reported is relevant and representative of what's happening. I think that's been one thing that's come up with the past order. So I think just those kinds of things are really important to think about in moving forward. And, you know, we've all been at this for a really long time, and it is important to be able to at least start to show progress. You know, we're not going to obviously, it's taken a long time to even show improvement in some of the monitoring sites. So it's going to take a lot of work, but I think we're moving in the right direction. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Your turn.
Good afternoon. We're almost done, right? I'm Lowell Zielinski. I have a PhD in soils from the University of California, Davis, 100 years ago. I work with a number of the larger Tier 3 growers in the Monterey area in the Salinas Valley, and help them comply with Regional Water Quality Control Board requirements. A little bit more background. I was a member of the statewide expert panel on nitrates. So, and we talked a lot about, at that time, AR ratios and A minus R. And I've thought about it since then, and I've come up with some other ideas, and I would like to share those with you. And I've worked with grower-shipper with Abby and Kirk and those guys. But one of the things we need to do is determine how much N is removed, right? And the way we do that is we take the yields and multiply it times the concentration. The major problem is we have so many crops that we don't know the concentrations, right? So that's a major holdup in getting this done. One thing that most people don't realize, when you look at nutritional components of crops or foods, when they report the protein content, they're actually measuring the nitrogen in that crop and multiplying it times some factor to get you the protein. If you can go, you can go backwards and get the protein levels, which is on all of the commodities, and then go back to what the nitrogen concentration is. So there is a way of getting to the nitrogen concentration of all the commodities without doing multiple years of research. These won't be perfect numbers, but they'll be a good first estimate. Secondly, again, looking at the AR ratios, I don't think that's really what we want to look at. I thought about it for a long time, and the growers cannot really control how much nitrogen is removed, right? That's based, it's just what it is. It's how much, what the yield is and stuff like that. But they really can't control that. And they really can't control how much nitrogen is required in the plants to grow the plants. So there's another concept which I stole from agronomy or from field crop research called nitrogen use efficiency. It's the nitrogen required, so the nitrogen that's in the harvested component and the nitrogen that's in the portion of the crop that's grown but it's not harvested, divided by the amount of N you apply. Growers can only really influence the amount of N that they apply. The lower amount of N that you apply, the higher your nitrogen use efficiency is. Okay, because the N required is the same. As you apply less N, the ratio of those two things, the nitrogen use efficiency, goes up. Growers, you heard about the four R's. Those are the things that will influence the nitrogen use efficiency. Those are the things that the growers can modify in themselves. And one last little comment. Work with Chris and Elaine. They're wonderful to work with. They accept my phone calls, and they actually will set aside time to meet with me, and I love it. And I'd also like to say I strongly support the idea of a technical working group from outside experts to help the staff develop these ideas. So thank you very much.
Thank you. And next will be James Green, and the last speaker card will be for Jane Sobey.
Good afternoon, James Green with the San Luis Obispo County Farm Bureau. I don't have a lot to say. Most of it was covered already in the panel discussions. Just a few things that our membership have brought up and continue to bring up is their number one concern is privacy of proprietary information. That's always their biggest concern. We have a lot of relatively small operations in our county, so it's really burdensome to get. It's easy to overload our farmers in our areas because there are a lot of mom and pop operations. Also, we feel that some of the crop types should be categorized, like lettuce is lettuce instead of five different types of lettuce. Should be robust discussion on the option to form an approved third-party coalition. And I think that addresses what Chris said. Members get something with the water board letterhead on it, and they get scared automatically. If we had a third-party coalition, that would solve that problem. And, you know, a great way to get communication to the growers is through our organizations. You can send Farm Bureau whatever you want, and I can send it out. So that's all I have, and thank you very much.
All right, thank you, and appreciate your input. And last will be Ms. Jane Sobey.
That's Jane Sobey. Thank you very much. My name is Jane Sobey. I'm with the California Certified Organic Farmers, CCOF, and I will try and squeeze all of these concepts into 3 minutes. I may need another half a minute or so. And Chairman Wolf, I want to let you know that if there's time afterwards, I'm happy to answer your questions that you raised earlier about a use of manure and certified organic production. So first of all, I want to thank you, directors, for convening a farmer panel. These are the experts and the innovators. And I also wanted to thank each of the panelists who presented today and the hard work that went into planning these presentations. I've pulled together a number of observations based on what I've been thinking about and what I've heard today. And first of all, I suggested an answer to the question posed by Mr. Young and the entire board. How can we all reduce pesticide and nutrient entry into water, incentivize practices that reduce fertilizer and pesticide use? It's really kind of straightforward. In a moment, I'll get to my suggestion for how to incentivize it. There are many agricultural practices that our certified organic farmers use that reduce. They don't use any synthetic fertilizers or persistent pesticides. Use of vacuums to manage Liguus and Striberries that Chair Wolf mentioned earlier is one example, and that work has been pioneered on organic farms. There are other key production practices such as crop rotation and cover cropping, which reduce the need for pesticides by disrupting pest life cycles, keeps the soil covered, reducing erosion, and also helps to build soil structure, which enhances soil water capacity of soils. using biologically based fertility inputs instead of synthetic fertilizers also reduces nitrate leaching. There is nitrate leaching from organic systems. It's not 100% nitrogen tight, but there is definitely reduced leaching, as we see in numerous scientific studies. Certified organic farming integrates these practices into a verifiable and federally enforced set of production standards. Our farmers are inspected every year to verify that they are following the standards. Organic farmers use these soil building practices and biologically based fertility inputs such as composts and incorporated cover crops. Of course, these inputs and practices can also be used by conventional growers. And I encourage the board to find ways to incentivize both organic and conventional farmers utilizing environmentally friendly farming practices. One idea to incentivize them is to rework the tier system and make it fluid so that a grower who is making a concerted effort to reduce pesticides and nutrients, perhaps by using certain practices, can move into a lower tier of regulation. Reduced reporting requirements and reduced frequency of testing can be built into tiers and might be effective incentives. The water boards are faced with the challenge of developing appropriate metrics. One more minute, please. Thank you. Previous speakers offered many reasons why a crop that had been irrigated and fertilized might not finally be harvested, which would skew the A to R ratio. And I appreciate one of the people who actually developed that concept kind of saying that it might not be the best measurement. The board may achieve its objectives by focusing on nitrogen applied and leaving R out of the equation entirely. This will also obviate the need to calculate coefficients for the diverse crops grown in this region. Finally, I would also endorse the idea of convening an advisory group. The timing is ideal as we move into fall and winter. That's a good time for growers to participate in meetings. We have rich expertise here on the Central Coast. I suggest that we invite cooperative extension specialists, organic and conventional growers, and representatives of environmental groups to participate in such an advisory group. We all need to talk to each other. We're really on the same side and desire the same outcomes: safe, clean drinking water for all, thriving local agriculture, and a healthy environment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I had a couple of other speaker cards that got mixed up, so my apology. I got two more. Mr. Dave Costa. And then last will be Norm, although, you know, Norm, you were the facilitator. You were not technically a speaker, so Norm, certainly you'll get your 3 minutes. Oh, that was to say goodbye? All right. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman Wolf, members of the board. My name is David Costa, Costa Farms. In meetings in the past, I can think of one in particular. I stood here and you had mentioned, you know, from the board, well, we understand what you're doing, but we want to understand what others are doing and what their challenges are. And I think today was a great example of that. We're thankful for that opportunity. But you saw, I think, what the knowledge and the skill set and the education and experience and the passion is that so many people have in our industry. And so I think it was great that, you know, that this group was put together and we had this opportunity to speak before you. There was an earlier slide today that showed historical lettuce yields and historical nitrogen use. And I just wanted to tie that together with, I think, one of the core facts that, you know, that we've, you know, always felt in so many of our operations, in kind of general numbers on a couple of our key crops that we grow. 30 or 35 years ago, we applied between 225 and 250 pounds of nitrogen per acre for a yield that was in the 750 to 850 carton range. And that number now for us on those same two crops is about 150 to 175 pounds per acre, and a yield expectation that's in the 1,150 to 1,200 acre range. So I hope you're really focused on that and are taking that to heart. And I wanted to share these kind of numbers from the years that, you know, that I can recall in my years of working on our farm after I finished college. When Tim Burrell talked about changing behavior at the soil surface, it needs to be understood that those changes that we make at the soil surface won't be reflected for some time in water quality measurements as it's relating to nitrates in our groundwater. And some of those, we fully expect it's going to be decades. We can't make a change here today and expect a change in the result tomorrow. A couple of areas that we farm up on the east side of Chular, it's 250 to near 300 feet to groundwater. So a decade or two might be a conservative, estimate, and it could be longer than that before we'd expect to see that kind of change. And in the discussion about, incentivizing and not penalizing, I felt like we never got to the bottom of that. And I think Claire was trying to get to it when she was discussing her letter, but, I think that we're really just looking to not get penalized for making prudent agronomic decisions. If we have a multiple well ranch or a two well ranch and we only need to run one well, we should be trying to, consume those nitrates from that higher nitrate well and get those back in the loop where they have an opportunity to be uptaken. And if you're having to report that end to the point where it throws you into an out, even if you didn't apply any other end, if that sample result is high enough, it could throw you into an outlier category. And I think, to me, that was the point of that discussion, was not ending up in an outlier category when you made the most prudent agronomic decision you can make based on the facts at hand you had with your water. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave. Appreciate it. And we're moving toward the end here. I wanted to see if any of my colleagues had any parting comments. I look on my right. Nope. My left. Nope. Oh, sorry.
Thank you. Mr. Costa, question for you. Focusing on the improvement that you have seen at your farm with the increased yield and decreased fertilizer usage, does that correspond at all to an improvement in water quality from your data?
Well, two parts of that answer for me is the part that I hadn't mentioned in making that statement was the fact that any analysis of what's happened in the last 2 or 3 years on our ranch in terms of applied versus removal is not going to. That's not going to show up. That those changes that have gone on for decades as those graphs have separated. If in an analysis of our applied and removal, I expect it to be a pretty flat line. When you're doing the math on it, because we've gotten down to more of that kind of fine tuning area with more minimal changes and gains to be made. I think we've seen a mixed bag in terms of our end sampling results in terms of wells. We've seen some that have gone down. We saw one that went down because we had a backflow issue with the device that wasn't operating correctly. That was corrected about 3 years ago. We've seen that changed. We've seen some change depending on the winter that we've had. We've seen some change regardless of the type of winter we had, so we can't attribute it all to leaching or heavy rainfall that's changed a nitrate sample result. So I think we see, a little bit of a mixed bag. And so I'd say it's really site dependent, sometimes dependent on our depth of groundwater, the soils surrounding the well, gradients, groundwater gradients. We've done a ton of work with one consultant, just trying to assess all the things that could potentially be involved with our contribution to what we're doing and what we're seeing in our results.
So it sounds like you can't really be certain as to whether the reduced use of fertilizer is having a beneficial effect on the resulting water quality.
Because there's
all these other factors going on at the same time.
Well, I think the biggest issue is the time lag. I mean, I think that I got to figure out how to put it into the right words, but
I fully expect to see that, but I don't expect to see it today or tomorrow, but I expect to see it, you know, in my lifetime or in my working lifetime, you know, in the next several years. I mean, if we weren't confident that what we were doing was going to make an impact, we'd be trying to figure out how to do something differently or reassess our approach to things.
Well, what years correspond to the data that you repeated to us?
I guess I would talk about an evolution that started, you know, the numbers, the first numbers that I shared with you were from back in like the mid-80s, late 80s, early 90s, in that range. You know, we weren't sampling to the extent that we are through the late 90s or, you know, early 2000s. So, you know, when we really started assessing, I would say, you know, nitrate, some of our nitrate concentrations, I mean, it was a long, you know, some of those effects maybe we've already seen. And, you know, the bottom line for me is I think we still see, you know, a mixed bag. I think there's places where we see progress and we're expecting to see progress, and there's places where we don't, and we're trying to understand why, and there's no simple equation. It's not a black and white equation. There's no timeline in print that tells us if you do this, you're going to see the results here. But all, you know, we keep trying to chisel down just our decision making and our analysis and our, you know, search for answers to our questions with, you know, people that know more than we do. I think on the research side, just some of the cause and effect type of thing in terms of what we're able to control and where do we go from here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dave. So this concludes today's workshop, but I would like to very specifically thank all of the presenters. And I think because at this workshop, I felt we had a very positive, collaborative, and congenial workshop. And that is very, very much appreciated, because a lot of you come and speak to us, you know, this is your livelihood, and it's very easy sometimes to let, you know, the emotions come through. But I would say that this was very, very impressive. I very much appreciate the effort all of you made. And so tomorrow, likewise, I look forward to a very positive, collaborative, and congenial discussion on this very important topic. So this concludes our Thursday, September 20th, 2018 Regional Water Quality Control Board meeting, and it is 10 past 5. Thank you.